Hello, ladies. Happy Sunday. In our household, we are days away, or hopefully just days away, from welcoming another baby. So this is probably the last episode that we'll be able to produce this calendar year. I want to revisit a quote from Dietrich von Hildebrand, which we shared quite some time ago, over 2 years ago, in September of 2021. This quote is from the book Marriage, The Mystery of Faithful Love. Quote, "Love is a task and a duty for both partners, because our laziness, our dullness, and our constant falling back into the periphery stultifies our vision. It is difficult always to keep before us, in all its same clarity and splendor, the image of the other person so wonderfully revealed by love. We should and must fight against this dullness, for it constitutes a sin against the temple which we erected in our marriage. In a certain sense, we are already unfaithful to the other when we cease to see him from within, when we understand no longer the deepest character of his being, but regard him as we would regard other people from the outside." End quote. I want to invite you to sit with that for a moment. I'm actually going to read that again. Because again, I'd like for us to sit with that for a moment. Quote, "Love is a task and a duty for both partners. Because our laziness, our dullness, and our constant falling back into the periphery stultifies our vision. It is difficult always to keep before us, in all its same clarity and splendor, the image of the other person so wonderfully revealed by love. We should and must fight against this dullness, for it constitutes a sin against the temple which we erected in our marriage. In a certain sense, we are already unfaithful to the other when we cease to see him from within, when we understand no longer the deepest character of his being, but regard him as we would regard other people from the outside." End quote. The focus of today's episode is authentic vulnerability. And to get us off on the right foot, let's begin with an extremely brief recap of Trinitarian theology. Each person of the Trinity is fully God, not one third of God, but fully God. When we encounter one person of the Trinity, we encounter God in his fullness. And yet, by some great mystery, we encounter and comprehend God more fully by encountering all three persons of the Trinity. We find similar language in the basics of the theology of the body, which is that man by himself has the ability to image the fullness of God, and that woman by herself has the ability to image the fullness of God. And yet again, by some great mystery, we encounter and comprehend God more fully by encountering man and woman together. Now, I'm using these brief recaps to set the stage for the language I will be using to explain vulnerability. Authentic vulnerability is a state of being, of existing. In our relationship with God, each and every single one of us exists in total vulnerability to him, as our existence is contingent upon him. Were any one of us to ever leave the thought of God, we would cease to exist. Now, our awareness and experience of that state of vulnerability in which we exist can be enriched and enhanced by intentional conversation with God, but the absence of intentional conversation with him has absolutely no bearing on the reality of our vulnerability to him. The person who does not pray still exists in a state of total vulnerability to God, in that their existence is contingent upon remaining within the thought of God. So another way that you might think of this is with regards to nakedness. When two naked people are facing each other in a room, there is no need to go up to the other person and point out the basic fact that one is naked. And yet, the comprehension and experience of nakedness is enriched and enhanced by intentional engagement between naked persons. So now let's look at marriage. Authentic vulnerability between spouses is a state of being. It is the reality of being one flesh. Our comprehension and experience and awareness of that vulnerability is enriched and enhanced by our intentional engagement with our spouse, by our work to keep seeing our spouse from within, as von Hildebrand says, working to keep in front of us at all times the clarity and splendor of the image of the other person so wonderfully revealed by love. And yet, a lack of intentional engagement does not fundamentally change the reality of existing as one flesh, in total vulnerability to the other person. I have wanted to treat this subject of authentic vulnerability for some time, because we frequently see in struggling marriages and crisis marriages this idea among wives that what is lacking from their marriage is vulnerability. Why is this? It would seem to be because struggling wives tend to equate vulnerability with verbal communication that has no parameters. They use the term vulnerability interchangeably with this concept. When women in struggling or crisis marriages say that they desire a deeper vulnerability with their husbands, the overwhelming majority of the time, what that actually translates into is that they want to be able to tell their husband about anything and everything that bothers them about him, and moreover, they want him to receive whatever they say as constructive feedback. They want to be able to talk about what they perceive to be the issues in the marriage. And again, they use the term vulnerability to mean the ability to be as blunt and straightforward as they think the situation warrants. And then for their husbands to then take instruction from that as to how they can be a better person for their wife. So these wives, they kind of want a checklist. They want to know all the things they have to do before they can be, quote, vulnerable with their husbands. They want to know how long it's going to take to get to that point in their marriage where they can be, quote, vulnerable. Again, using the term interchangeably with a specific type of, shall we say, lawless communication. And they want a cheat sheet for what words to use and what tone to take and how to set up the situation in order to guarantee that their husband will respond differently from how he's been responding up until this point. Usually they will explain that their husband shuts down or withdraws or gets angry or even goes and talks to someone else, like another woman. Not necessarily a single woman. I'm not suggesting this automatically leads to an affair, but a woman, meaning maybe their mom or their sister or a married colleague. It happens. And then you hear women complaining about how interfering their mother-in-laws are or their sister-in-law or, you know, how things can get awkward with a female colleague because their husband has been sharing their marriage problems with this colleague. All of this to say, it is incredibly difficult to explain to these women two things. The first thing is that authentic vulnerability has nothing to do with communication style. It is not about using nice words, nice phrases, and even tone. It is not even about the ability to cry in front of someone, because tears can also be manipulative. And that's what we're getting at here. Vulnerability in marriage is not the ability to say whatever you like about a person and have it not hurt the relationship. Again, they want for their communication to be received as constructive feedback. They want their husband to be able to take constructive feedback about the things he does to anger them, to make them sad, to make them feel insecure, to make them feel afraid, to make them feel deprioritized, etc., and operate off of that information. And so, yes, the first thing that's very difficult to explain is that authentic vulnerability is not the ability to unload their own emotional overload onto their husbands and expect him to take it in a manner that they would consider nice and well-behaved, and for them to have some sort of checklist that ensures that he will be nice and well-behaved in his response. Does this sound like manipulation? Because it is. What is actually missing from these marriages, and this constitutes the second thing that is extremely difficult to explain to these women, what is actually missing from these marriages is respect. When we start trying to explain that what is missing from the relationship is actually respect, there is almost always an immediate objection of, well, but shouldn't we be able to discuss issues in healthy relationships? And the answer to that is yes, absolutely. However, a healthy relationship means two healthy individuals. And here is what healthy individuals do before ever getting to a conversation about a supposed issue. Number one, healthy individuals in healthy relationships give each other an incredible amount of grace. 1 Peter chapter 4 verse 8 reminds us that love covers a multitude of sins. Healthy individuals in healthy relationships are incredibly forgiving people. They assume the best of their partner. Again, going back to that quote at the very beginning of this episode from von Hildebrandt, they see their partner from within, and they consider any flaws to be deviations from the beautiful person that their partner actually is. So when their spouse happens to do something which bothers them, their immediate assumption is that this is unintentional and that this is an anomaly. If the behavior persists, then the second thing that healthy individuals in healthy relationships do is that they assess the situation from every angle other than that of assuming that they are simply a victim. They are still assuming the best of their spouse. They are still giving their spouse grace, and they look at a given situation and say, okay, what is my part in this situation? Because they know that marriage is a dance, and there is no such thing as neutrality. And so the healthy individual will ask themselves, is there something that I'm doing, whether or not it's intentional, that triggers this behavior in my spouse? If the answer to that question is yes, then they ask, is it reasonable and realistic and holy to change this particular behavior? Because there is an aspect of, hey, my spouse is an adult, and if their expectation of my behavior is unreasonable, then that's between them and God to resolve. We've spoken often in this podcast about the potential for overextension, for rescuing our husbands, for not giving them the room to struggle in those ways in which they need to struggle in order to grow. So sometimes, again, if the change expected of the wife is unreasonable, is unrealistic, and ultimately unholy, then that doesn't make you a neutral party. There is a dynamic still of your behavior triggering another person. That dynamic exists. But you may determine that the best way to move forward is to keep on keeping on. Okay, going back to the original question, the healthy individual will ask themselves again, is there something that I'm doing, whether or not it's intentional, that triggers this behavior in my spouse? And if the answer to that is no, then there is yet another angle at which to consider the situation, which is, how am I responding to this behavior in my spouse? Am I a co-regulator, or am I a co-escalator in this situation? Once an individual has assessed their part in the situation, they figure out what they can do differently or not. They take full ownership of how they contribute to the dynamic of marriage, and they address what is in their own power to address, and also are able to step back with peace when they discern that there is something that only God can do for their spouse. When these things are done, the overwhelming majority of issues in marriage tend to just fade away. Why? Well, sometimes it's because we make mountains out of molehills, and we realize that, and we realize that we need to stop making mountains out of molehills. Sometimes. Well, most of the time, if we're being honest. But other times, because we realize and then accept maturely that there are things that only God can do for us because He is God. I get these women protesting, but God put my husband here to help me. Yes, He did, but He didn't do it in a way which limits His own power. To acknowledge that everything depends on God, and that God does not need to work through your husband in order to heal you, is not to love your husband any less. It is actually to respect him more. It is fundamentally disrespectful of both God and your husband to say that there are hurts which require your husband's involvement, that unless your husband is involved in a specific way, that even God cannot heal you. Yes, we want our husbands to respond to God's grace and be instruments of healing for us. That part of the equation in our healing, however, is between him and God. This goes back to our second episode, that women can only work through inspiration, not coercion or manipulation. If you can inspire your husband to take an active role in your healing, fantastic. And if you cannot inspire that dedication in your husband, the reality remains that God can still heal you. It is not loving your husband less, or even being unloving towards him, to embrace and to rely upon God's omnipotence. Men do not want to be your God. They know it is a burden which they cannot carry. This is what John Gray means when he says that men love to be needed but hate neediness. When I was in high school, there was a saying going around, you know, in email chains, whatever, that immature love says, I love you because I need you. And mature love says, I need you because I love you. I love you because I need you is an immature love because it comes from a place of taking. It is a self-centered love. That is easy enough to understand. That it is so immature to love a person only for what they can provide, and only for as long as they are both capable and willing to continue providing, right? I need you because I love you is a giving mindset, a selfless mindset, a mindset of I have my whole self to give, and I was made to give it to you. And that gift of self implies everything about the discipline of joy, which we outlined in the first year of this podcast. Emphasis on gift. If you give a gift, you're going to clean up that gift and fix up that gift and wrap up that gift prettily. And you're going to go above and beyond to give the best gift that you can possibly give. And how much work you've put into that gift is a sign of how much you love the person to whom you are giving it. In the giving of yourself, it means you're going to pursue sainthood and work on all your own faults and your own imperfections so that the gift that you give your spouse of yourself is as beautiful and as flawless as is within your power with God's grace to make it. I spoke in episode 2 about Eve putting Adam in a bad place where he had to choose between God and his wife. And that laid the foundation for what I think is more true now in a progressively more sinful culture and sin-filled world, that how the curse of Eve has played out is that women do not merely put their husbands in this position of choosing between them and God, but that they want to replace God in their husbands' lives. And that's really what is happening when women use the word vulnerability to mean, again, this sort of lawless communication. They want to be the primary guiding influence of their husband's behavior. If they hand their husband an apple, they expect him to eat it without question. The saddest thing about all of this is that women deeply desire to be cherished. You know, in literature, we just love when suitors or husbands are described as worshiping the ground that their woman walks on. And it seems that we miss the fact that Adam cherished Eve the most when his love for her was rightly ordered. The reaction of Adam to meeting Eve, that illustration of Adam being thunderstruck by her presence, was not because Eve replaced God, but because she made God more visible to Adam, more accessible to Adam, more comprehensible to Adam. And when women, in co-opting the use of the word vulnerability to mean being able to tell their husband how he lets them down, or even how he hurts them, is to pull their husband's focus away from the unconditional love of God and towards the conditional love of the fallen human person. That kind of conversation witnesses to the depth of the imperfections and susceptibility to evil of the fallen human being, rather than witnessing to the capacity of each of us for God, for holiness, for perfection, for glory. Why do our men not cherish us? Because we do not do for them what Eve did for Adam at the moment that he met her. We do not make God more visible to our husbands. We do not make God more accessible to our husbands. We do not make God more comprehensible to our husbands. That is why they do not cherish us as much as they might, as much as they are called to, as much as they are created to. We want the effects of sin on us to inform our husband's behavior. We want the level to which he has been informed to be visible to us and measurable by us. And we want to be able to say if it is enough. We touched on this in the first episode of the Healthy Holy Beauty series. Women want eyes on their husband's interaction with God. And the reality is that the intimacy and vulnerability between spouses, that state of existing as one flesh, only goes so far. It is intended to be a foretaste of heaven, but it cannot, by any means, capture the state of vulnerability in which the human person exists in relation to God. There is a part of your husband which is reserved for God, a part into which you can never enter, into which you are not made to enter, into which you have not the capacity to enter. And frankly, that incapacity is evidenced most clearly by your inability to let the matter go. Again, there is no neutrality in marriage. Your husband is involved in some way, on some level, in all of your hurts and all of your healing by virtue of the fact that you are one flesh. Your desire, however, to dictate what his involvement in your healing looks like is not a desire which brings him closer to God, as is your duty to do, but rather pulls him farther away from God by keeping his focus on the contingency, on the caveats, on the limitations of fallen human love, instead of broadening his vision to better grasp what it means to love you unconditionally as God does. Why do men resist when women tell them that doing this or doing that or not doing this or not doing that will make their wife happier, will make her feel safer, more secure? Why? Because it is an undue burden. He does not want to be your God. If your happiness, if your safety, if your security, if your sense of identity is dependent on your husband's good behavior, you have made him your God, and he cannot bear it. He knows it, so he will not. I'm going to shift again slightly and just touch on involuntary versus voluntary triggers. Triggers we've formed involuntarily and triggers we've developed deliberately. Deliberately meaning it was always in our control from the beginning if we were going to allow it to become a trigger or not. I'll use a sort of silly example for the latter because, frankly, usually the voluntary triggers tend to be sillier. Not always, but quite often. Things like, he puts his dishes next to the sink instead of in the sink, or on the counter directly over the dishwasher instead of inside the dishwasher. Okay, so many of our voluntary triggers, triggers which we've, again, always had control over whether or not we're going to choose to be bothered by it, are these kinds of triggers. It is amazing how many marriages suffer so intensely from these sorts of very small things that have simply piled up and compounded and that have become overwhelming because, frankly, we've allowed them to become overwhelming. There is so much that bothers us about our husbands because we allow it to. And we get so entrenched in these triggers that the idea that we ever had control over their initial formation has become incomprehensible to us. The idea that we could have chosen to never be upset about where the dishes end up is a thoroughly foreign concept to us. How many marriages suffer so terribly because of these silly things that do not have to be a point of contention? Now, if you tell me that he's putting them on the edge of the counter haphazardly, and you are, on an almost daily basis, needing to sweep up broken glass and ceramic, and that your children have needed stitches because they crawl into the kitchen and straight onto broken glass, that's something completely different. But that is not what I'm hearing. I'm hearing he didn't take 30 seconds to put it in the sink. Or 5 seconds, we should say. 30 seconds to put it into the dishwasher. And they've allowed that to become a point of serious contention in the marriage. Okay, so let's talk about triggers which are involuntary. These triggers are what we are talking about when we talk about emotional dysregulation. Dysregulation, we need to define, is being in fight, flight, or freeze mode. This mode has been automatically triggered by our body's perception of a threat. The body does not distinguish between a physical threat and a non-physical threat. And in this mode, this fight, flight, or freeze mode, part of our brain is shut down. That part being the part which is responsible for learning. So when we find ourselves in a state of emotional dysregulation, the will was not initially involved. We had no control over our body's perception of the threat. We did not, shall we say, invite the tiger to stalk us. However, the reason I want to talk about this is because we have just as much of a responsibility to address these involuntary triggers as we do the voluntary ones. It is very easy to employ a victim mentality mindset when it comes to emotional dysregulation. Again, our body does not distinguish between a physical threat and a non-physical threat. So, example, your child starts screaming bloody murder, okay? Your body responds automatically. You are triggered. And this is where we start talking about strategies and methods to emotionally regulate, right? We need those strategies and methods because we have found ourselves in a state of dysregulation. It's easy to say that we're victims, right? But the problem that we need to treat in this episode is that we're victims of emotional dysregulation in the same way that we're victims of original sin. Yes, I had no say in being born a daughter of Eve. Even so, I am called to holiness. Even so, I am called to strive against the effects of original sin. Emotional dysregulation is actually fundamentally a spiritual battle. And the key to understanding that is understanding how emotions fit into the spiritual life. Here's what the Catechism says. A quick note that the word used in the Catechism and also used normally in theological texts is the word passion. So when you hear the word passion, it means emotion. So hear these passages from the Catechism with that understanding. Passion is used to mean emotion, and that's addressed in this first excerpt. This is paragraph 1763. Quote, "The term passions belongs to the Christian patrimony. Feelings or passions are emotions or movements of the sensitive appetite that incline us to act or not to act in regard to something felt or imagined to be good or evil," end quote. Okay, so passions equals emotions. Moving on to paragraph 1767. Quote, "In themselves, passions are neither good nor evil. They are morally qualified only to the extent that they effectively engage reason and will. Passions are said to be voluntary, either because they are commanded by the will or because the will does not place obstacles in their way. It belongs to the perfection of the moral or human good that the passions be governed by reason," end quote. Okay, so let's look at this passage in light of the two types of triggers that we just discussed. Triggers which we have developed voluntarily, meaning we chose to let them become triggers, though they did not need to be, are referred to in the Catechism as passions which are commanded by the will. But dysregulation is also covered here, referred to here as passions against which the will places no obstacle. And again, that final line of this paragraph, paragraph 1767, quote, "It belongs to the perfection of the moral or human good that the passions be governed by reason," end quote. Here now is paragraph 1768 from the Catechism. Quote, "Strong feelings are not decisive for the morality or the holiness of persons. They are simply the inexhaustible reservoir of images and affections in which the moral life is expressed. Passions are morally good when they contribute to good action, evil in the opposite case. The upright will orders the movements of the senses. It appropriates to the good and to beatitude. An evil will succumbs to disordered passions and exacerbates them. Emotions and feelings can be taken up into the virtues or perverted by the vices," end quote. So, in short, whether or not we are talking about a trigger which we have consciously developed, or an automatic trigger which lands us in a state of emotional dysregulation, we have a personal responsibility, either way, to work to learn to govern our emotions with reason, whether proactively by re-examining our voluntary triggers and working to eliminate the unnecessary ones, or reactively by learning and consistently practicing whatever strategies or methods are necessary to address our moments of emotional dysregulation. Our emotions are gifts from God. They are morally neutral in and of themselves. However, it requires work, self-awareness, intentionality to ensure that we govern our emotions rather than allowing our emotions to govern us. How we manage our emotions, our passions, determines in great part our level of spiritual maturity. So now, going back to the question, is it not true of healthy relationships that issues can be discussed openly? The answer is yes. However, a healthy conversation between healthy individuals in a healthy relationship about a legitimate issue which needs to be addressed, meaning that they have taken great pains to discern if it is truly necessary to involve the other party. That conversation is in the same spirit which has made so many other conversations thoroughly unnecessary. That is a spirit of giving grace in abundance, of assuming the best of the other person, of forgiving much, of recognizing the myth of neutrality in marriage, and of putting one's self forward as able and available to change as demanded by the universal call to holiness. When healthy individuals in healthy relationships determine that there is an issue which does merit discussion, the person who brings the issue forward does so because he or she wishes to be able to make a greater gift of self. That is their focus. It is a selfless motive. Immature and unhealthy individuals wish to have those discussions because their focus is self-centered. Their intention is to bring to the other party's attention how the other party is failing them. And they further intend to instruct the other party as to how to treat them better. In short, it is a mindset and attitude focused on taking, not on giving. Our work to ensure that we govern our emotions rather than allowing our emotions to govern us is part and parcel of our spiritual warfare, of our personal battle with evil. It is part and parcel of our sincere pursuit of sainthood and our response to the universal call to holiness. Finally, it is not lawless communication which determines, much less constitutes, authentic vulnerability. Vulnerability is a fixed reality, a state of being. Our intentional engagement, perhaps through conversation, can enhance and enrich our awareness and experience of that vulnerability. However, the conversations which immature and unhealthy individuals wish to initiate are ones which actually make the reality of that vulnerability even more unattractive and undesirable to the other party. The other party walks away from the conversation perceiving only the great burden that existing in such a state of vulnerability to another person places upon them. And consequently, it is unsurprising when the other party, upon whom this lawless communication has been foisted, seeks to escape the relationship. Okay, this was a longer episode, but hopefully that's enough to chew on through Thanksgiving, through the Advent season, through the Christmas season, and into next year, because over here at our house, our next biggest focus is having this baby. So, God bless all of you. We will see you again in 2024.